Mother, I know this letter of yours now is, of course, not about marriage, but what is it about? A weekend visit? You don't say that you love me. Do you want to experiment now that you have time on your hands? Charles, I want to live. I want to survive. I don't want to be driven mad a second time. When I consider it all now, I'm just afraid to come near you. You would have to convince me, and I suspect you can't. You once said yourself how much A loves B shows, like your slip showing. We haven't met for more than a year. The last time was that luncheon for Sidney Ash, and how intensely I looked forward to it, and you scarcely spoke to me. Then I wanted to leave with you in that taxi, and you suddenly asked Nell Pickering to come too. You've probably forgotten. You haven't communicated with me since. You haven't telephoned or sent a line, although you know I would be wild with joy to hear from you. You don't even know where I live. You had to send the letter care of my agent. All this is evidence, Charles. And now suddenly you write this funny, ambiguous letter. It's just an idea you've had. There's something sort of abstract about it. You've probably thought better of it already. If I came to see you like you want, just coming because you feel in the mood to see me, to sort of try my company again, I would fall straight back into the old madness. I don't mean that I ever really got over it, but I've lived. I've managed. I've even put some sort of order into my life at last. I've had long enough, after all, since you left me. You never fully knew how mad I was in those days. I didn't want to hurt you by showing you my pain by way of revenge. All the time we were together, I knew every minute, every second that it would end. You told me often enough. But somehow, I was that mad. I embraced the suffering. If I could have suffered more, I would have suffered more. I wonder if you've ever loved anyone like that. Maybe you only understood it on the stage. I think I fell in love with you when you were shouting at Romeo and Juliet, "Don't touch each other!" You kept saying there was this great love when you were young, but I think that was just to console me for your not loving me enough. Anyway, you didn't love me enough. And now, I don't believe in miracles. Charles, I've been in hell, and I've come out of it, and I don't want to go there again. Jealousy is hell, and I'm not cured. Suppose I come to you with all that old love, and you smile and stroll away. You're free. Your letter made that clear, all right. Forgive me, but you know how people talk. Everybody tells everybody everything, and I still keep meeting girls I didn't even know you knew who say they've had romances with you. They may be lying, of course. You know you can't keep your hands off women, and I'm not young and beautiful anymore, and you like chasing what isn't easy to get. You don't want to stay with anyone. In the end, you drop everyone. You once said getting married was like buying a doll, which shows what you think of marriage. And I don't believe you've really retired. Gilbert said it was like God retiring. You're too restless. You made me act. You made everyone act. You're like a very good dancer. You make other people dance, but it's got to be with you. You don't respect people as people. You don't see them. You're not really a teacher. You're a sort of rapacious magician. How can I imagine that all this could stop? Do you want me as a sort of patient friend, a chaperone with knitting, a calm, wise older woman, a sort of retired senior wife to whom you can complain about the others? It wouldn't work, Charles. I'm not calm and wise. I'd want everything. You could still have children. I remember you saying more than once how much you wanted a son. You could still have a son, only I couldn't bear him. Oh, Charles. Charles, why didn't you marry me long ago? I loved you so much. I love you so much. Only I can't put my head into that noose. My love for you is quiet at last. I don't want it to become a roaring furnace. And there is something else I must tell you. I am living with Gilbert Opion. You obviously didn't know you'd have mentioned it in the letter. I know you made me promise to let you know if I ever settled down permanently with anyone. I was so hurt when Rita Gibbons told me you'd made her promise that, too. I didn't tell her about my promise. She says she doesn't regard hers as binding because it was given under duress. I didn't tell you about Gilbert because I'm not living like that with him. I mean, we're not lovers, of course not. Gilbert hasn't suddenly become heterosexual. We just love each other and care for each other, and we share a house, and... Charles, I have been happy for the first time in my life. This is the most creative thing I've ever done, far more than acting. I was living like this when we met at Sydney's lunch, and I would have told you then if you'd shown any interest and really asked. And, Charles, I've left the theatre, and I feel so much better. Honestly, the theatre was always a torment for me. I only shone for you, and when you left me, I faded. I was never much good, anyhow. When I look back and see what a miserable, stupid, anxious, messy existence I led over years and years, I can't think how I tolerated it. I was perfectly capable of being happy, but somehow I always managed not to be. Men were always being beastly to me. Gilbert is so different. Don't sneer at this. I've been bullied by bloody men all my life. Now I have a decent, orderly, cheerful existence. I'm even useful. I work part-time in a hospital office. I'm learning to paint, and I write children's stories, none published yet. You may think this sounds pathetic, but for me it's happiness and freedom. And Gilbert is happy, too. He's stopped fretting about being unsuccessful and not being a star. He can get some small parts, and he works a bit on TV. We're not rich, but we can earn money and look after each other. Tenderness and absolute trust and communication and truth. These things matter more and more as one grows older. Gilbert's given up hunting. He says all he ever wanted was love, but he's got mine. It's all somehow suddenly simple and innocent. It seems to me now we were all brainwashed about sex. Please understand, dear, dear Charles, and do not be angry. You know, and I won't go on about this because it used to annoy you, how much Gilbert loves you too. Really, he worships you, but he's so frightened now. He says you'll come with a troika and carry me off to the gypsies. I suppose that's a quotation. You always said I read nothing but Shakespeare, and then only my own part. He is frightened of you still, and so am I. The habit of obeying you is strong in both of us. Don't use your power to hurt us. You could put the most terrible pressure on us, only don't do it. Be generous, dear heart. You could drive us both mad. We've come a long road to solving our problems, and if some people think it's a funny solution, that's just because they lack imagination and intelligence. And you lack neither. Charles, I don't want to see you now, yet. I'd simply succumb. I've got to recover from your letter. Please write and say you are not angry. When I am calmer, let's meet, and you must come here and see Gilbert, too. There must be a way. Your letter has made an aching emptiness and a need, and I shall not be the same. But I am happy here, and Gilbert needs me, and we have this house. It's half a house, actually, which we have made together, and if I left him, it would be a terrible smash-up for both of us. We'd be in pieces. Anyway, I don't know what you want. And whatever it was, you may not want it now. Oh, God. Gilbert says you must in the end receive us as if we were your children. Oh, Charles, I'm amazed at the strength of those forces which I commanded to sleep. It is all there still, all my old love for you. Somehow, let us not waste love. It is rare enough. You have thought of me. You have written to me so sweetly, so generously. Can we not love each other and see each other at last in freedom, without awful possessiveness and violence and fear, now that we are growing old? I do so want us to love each other, but not in a way that would destroy me. I've felt so sad for years about you. My love for you has always had a sad face. Oh, the weakness of the power of love. You feel you can compel the beloved, but it's an illusion. I am crying as I write this. Please write at once and say that we can meet later, in a little while, and that you won't stop loving me. Somehow, don't lose that love, the love, whatever it may be, that made you write that letter. And we will look at each other. Always yours, Lizzie. I have been sitting for some time in the little red room where I have at last lit a successful fire. The chimney seems to have got over its smoking fit. Perhaps it was just that the wood was too wet. I have read Liz's letter through twice. Of course, it is a silly, inconsistent woman's letter, half saying the opposite of what it is trying to say. Lizzie cannot quite refrain from offering herself, and of course she does, in answer to my deliberately cool missive, protest too much. A cleverer woman might have replied coolly, and let me read between the lines. A cleverer woman, or a less sincere one. Lizzie's letter has its own little attempts at ambiguity, but they are transparent. Poor Lizzie. I cannot take the stuff about Gilbert Opin too seriously, though I do feel cross with her for not having told me, and I feel she has broken her promise. Besides, what are their relations? Lizzie's proximity is surely enough, even now, to convert any man to heterosexuality. Her breasts are enough. Do they drink cocoa together in their dressing gowns? The whole thing is rather horrid. Of course, Gilbert is nothing. He is a man of twigs. I could crush him with one hand and take Lizzie with the other. I certainly cannot envisage any platonic love trio. From the date of Lizzie's letter, it appears to have been in the dog kennel for well over a week. On reflection, this seems to be no bad thing. If I had received it at once, I might have been tempted to write an ill-tempered or facetious reply by return of post. As it is, she has had a silence to reflect upon. It may be best to prolong the silence. However, to repeat Liz's own perfectly reasonable question, what do I want? Why do women take everything so intensely and make such a fuss? Why do they always demand definitions, explanations? There are, in fact, some quite shrewd guesses in her letter, and the quiet outburst of resentment has not escaped me. Those wounding and not wholly unjust observations have doubtless been stored up for a long time. Perhaps I do want a sort of retired, part-time, senior wife figure, like an aging ex-concubine in a harem who has become a friend, a companion who is taken for granted, to whom one is close but not committed, except by bonds of friendship. This need not preclude occasional love-making. In fact, the harem situation would suit me down to the ground. Why can't Lizzie be intelligent enough to understand? My letter said nothing about time and space. I simply thought of her and wanted to see her. But then she will start asking absolute questions. An experiment? Yes, why not? She knows how I hate exhibitions of emotion, but she pours it all out all the same. She wants everything, does she? Well, she can't have it. And that, doubtless, is that. I feel no jealousy of Gilbert, but I feel a sort of envy of him. He is the clever one. He has got simple Lizzie as his sweet, affectionate housekeeper, and meanwhile I very much doubt whether he has given up hunting. I must confess I still have feelings of ownership about Lizzie. She has lasted in my mind. Yet she is quite right. Loving shows like one's slip showing, as I once said to her, when her slip was showing. Oh, these girls do treasure up one's words. I have neglected her. I have even been cruel, though that could be called a sign of love, and the neglect a sign of trust. I do, in fact, recall the business of the taxi after Sydney's luncheon. I saw that Lizzie was scheming to leave with me, but at the last moment I quite deliberately brought Nell Pickering along, too. Nell is the new musical comedy star with whom I had been flirting all through lunch. Nell is 22. I wouldn't mind having her in my harem. Poor Lizzie. What made me suddenly write that teasing, semi-serious letter to her, I wonder? Some fear of loneliness and death which has come to me out of the sea? Since the subject of Lizzie Scherer has come up, I may as well give some further account of her. I began to love Lizzie after I realized how much she loved me. As does sometimes happen, her love impressed me, then attracted me. I was directing a season of Shakespeare. She fell in love with me during Romeo and Juliet. She revealed her love during Twelfth Night. We got to know each other during A Midsummer Night's Dream. Then—but that was later—I began to love her during The Tempest, and But that was later still. I left her during Measure for Measure, when Aloysius Bull was playing the Duke. I recall very clearly that occasion when I first realized that Lizzie loved me. She was playing Viola. This was during Lizzie's brief shining period, her Annus Mirabilis. It was the production in which Wilfred Dunning, who usually played Sir Toby Belch, suddenly insisted on playing Malvolio. At least, he did not insist, I let him. It was a marvel, but it wrecked the production. Lizzie and I were alone in a rather draughty church hall, which for some reason was all we could get at that moment to rehearse in. It was a winter's evening, and I remember the place as being lit with gas. Lizzie, now in Act Two, Scene Four, got as far as "She never told her love." Then she stopped and seemed to choke and uttered no more. I thought at first that this was her own extremely effective idea of how to speak the speech, and I waited for her to go on. She gazed at me. Then huge, glistening tears rose into her eyes. When I realized what the matter was, I began to laugh and laugh and laugh, and after a bit Lizzie laughed, laughing and crying helplessly. And I loved her for that laughter, too. She was a good girl. She is a good girl. I somehow always picture Lizzie in breeches. She first won a little fame as principal boy in small provincial pantomimes. She was very slim in those days and rather boyish in appearance, and used to stride around in boots and cut her hair very short. Her great ambition, never realized, was to play Peter Pan. She was, briefly, quite serviceable as Shakespeare's transvestite girls. Sidney later directed her as Rosalind. I made her into an adorable Viola, but her greatest success in that historic season was as Puck. In Romeo and Juliet she was a mute lady. I forget who played Juliet, except that she was no good. I was touched by her love and by her superb obedience, but I was tied up with Rosina at the time, and I saw Lizzie as a wispish, enchanting, rather infantile sprite. Every time I met her I laughed, and then she laughed too. We used to laugh at each other across restaurants, and suddenly, and mysteriously, during rehearsals. I did not need to be told how much she loved me, though she never, even on the first occasion, said anything about it. I thought that was stylish of her. Throughout the dream, her radiant gaze rested on me. Her will touched my will and trembled. She understood and obeyed, and although, as she told me later, she knew about Rosina, she existed in a sort of heaven of suffering which, I must confess, gave me some gratification. Perhaps this gratification was a prophetic gleam from the love I was later to feel for her. And by then I was getting thoroughly tired of Rosina. In that production of The Dream, Al Bull, a most uneven actor, played Oberon rather boorishly, and I regretted not taking the part myself. Lizzie's cup would then have been full and running over. It was at the end of that season that I went to America, and there followed the horrible interlude in Hollywood and the first debacle with Fritzi Eitel. I think I went to Hollywood partly to escape from Rosina. In any case, I escaped. Rosina thought I left her because of Lizzie, but this was not so. When I came back to England again, there was suddenly an interval of peace and an atmosphere of restored innocence and joy. It was summer. I was on good terms with Clement, who had one of her silly young men at the time. I felt, after the horrors of California, free and happy. I wanted to get back to Shakespeare after the muck I had been wading through in America. A fly-by-night American director called Isaiah Mompson let me play Prospero. It was the last substantial part I ever played. Lizzie was Ariel. She was the most spiritual, most curiously accurate Ariel I ever saw. Her love for me made her so, and in the midst of all that magic, made me love her. Oddly, I felt then, and the feeling remains with me, that I loved her as if she were my son. She often called herself my page. She had a pretty little singing voice, and I can still hear the thin, true tone of her Full Fathom Five. Ah, now, after all these years, my Trixie spirit. I remember that she once played Cherubino in an amateur production of Figaro, and I think this tiny success was one of the things she valued most. Damn, it has just occurred to me that Gilbert Opium probably regards her as a boy. My love for Lizzie was somehow an innocent love. God, what messes I got into with Rita and Rosina and Jean and Doris and the rest. The innocence was Liz's pure gift. Her love was so scrupulous, so intelligent. She never used her power to lay upon me the lightest of moral bonds. The reader will say, but the bonds were there. Well, yes. And yet some grace born of Liz's selflessness seemed almost to abolish them, and we lived in the golden world. Of course, she never reproached me. It was as if she positively did not want me to feel any sense of duty towards her, but wanted me simply to use her for my happiness. Written so, this sounds crude. But as we lived it, it was the profoundest, humblest tact on her part, and on mine a love that was composed of gentle gratitude. We were gentle with each other. And yet, of course, it was also at the same time a scene of carnage. Why do I so much enjoy writing this down? I told her from the start that I had no conception of marrying her. Was it blind, stupid hope, nevertheless, which made her so infinitely kind to me? An ungrateful thought. I am sure she had no hope. I told her that the affair was temporary, that my love for her was temporary, and doubtless her love for me was temporary. I spoke of mortality and the fragile and shadowy nature of human arrangements and the jumbled unreality of human minds, while her large, light brown eyes spoke to me of the eternal. She said, "I want to be perfect for you so that you can leave me without pain." And this perfect expression of love simply irritated me. She said, "I will wait forever, although I know I am not waiting for anything." What a love duet. And how much I enjoyed it, although in her suffering I suffered a little too. Certainly she concealed her pain as much as she could, but towards the end it was impossible. She cried before me with wide-open eyes, not staunching the tears. Her tears fell on my sleeve, on my hand, like storm rain. And when at last I told her to go, she went like a shadow, with silent, swift obedience. After that I went on my second visit to Japan. The taste of sake still makes me remember Liz's tears. She never prospered in the theatre after I went away. All the ladies went downhill after I left them, except Rosina. Clement, of course, I never really left, even when we both had other lovers, which was rather horrid for the other lovers. 2 years after Liz's apotheosis as Ariel, they were asking, "Whatever happened to Lizzie Scherer?" I was so grateful to her, and this alone has made her last in my mind. The dear girl never made me feel guilty. A light of courage and truth shines on her in my memory. She is possibly the only woman, with one exception, who never lied to me. And the remembrance of her sufferings often filled me with a kind of tender joy, whereas when I think of the sufferings of other women, I tend to feel indifference, even annoyance. I wanted a wife, once, when I was young, but the girl fled. Since then I have never really, seriously thought of marriage. My observation of the state never made me fancy it. The only happily married couples I know at all well are my Cambridge friends, Victor and Julia Banstead, and in the theatre, Sidney and Rosemary Ashe. And even they, who knows? People are so secretive. I might also count Will and Adelaide Bowes, but they only survive because she gives in all the time, which I suppose is one method. What suits me best is the drama of separation, of looking forward to assignations and rendezvous. I cannot prefer the awful eternal presence of marriage to the magic of meetings and partings. I do not even care for sharing a bed, and I rarely want to spend the whole night with a woman I have made love to. In the morning she looks to me like a whore. Marriage is a sort of brainwashing which breaks the mind into the acceptance of so many horrors. How untidy and ugly and charmless married people often let themselves become without even noticing it. I sometimes reflect on these horrors simply in order to delight myself by thinking how I have escaped them. In this respect, Clement understood me perfectly, perhaps because she was always so excessively conscious of being old enough to be my mother. How often, glowing with that famous beauty and charm which she retained for so long, she battered me with that phrase. We knew that we would never marry, and we knew that we would make each other suffer, yet we schemed for our happiness. We really used our joint intelligence on that problem. Of course, in a way, it was a hopeless case, but it was a hopeless case which marvellously lasted for the rest of Clement's life. So I did not do too badly by that wonderful, maddening woman. Was I a little cruel to her, never quite saying how much I loved her, always trying to keep her on the hop, puzzled, baffled, at a disadvantage? Perhaps. I was afraid of being swallowed. I went away. I came back. I went away again. She was not alone either. She was always beset. I was never terribly jealous, except perhaps for a short while, of Marcus, because I had such a close connection with Clement, just as if, though I never used these words to her, she were indeed my mother. She became very irritable and possessive in the last years, and she went on so touchingly trying to please me. She could not stop flirting. When she was ill, she became rather hideous towards the end and had to be lied to about her appearance. She lost her figure and went about in corduroy trousers and a baggy jacket. She looked like an old bachelor with drink stains and snuff all down her clothes, yet still she would spend an hour a day doing her face. Perhaps that is the last pleasure which a woman leaves. No, I never considered marriage. That first girl made all the rest seem shoddy. Or perhaps it was just the comparison with Shakespeare's heroines. I'm writing this after dinner. For dinner I had an egg poached in hot, scrambled egg, then the coley braised with onions and lightly dusted with curry powder, and served with a little tomato ketchup and mustard. Only a fool despises tomato ketchup. Then a heavenly rice pudding. It is fairly easy to make very good rice pudding, but how often do you meet one? I drank half a bottle of Meursault to salute the coley. I am running out of wine. Lizzie, yes. She has stayed the course. I have felt more passion, with less comfort, elsewhere. The mysterious, deep, half-blind preferences of human beings for each other, the quick, probing tentacles that seek in the dark, why one inexplicably and yet certainly loves A and is indifferent to B. I was at ease with Lizzie. Her gentle, clever teasing made me feel free. Yes, the final question is, how much does one crave for someone's company? That is more radical. It matters more than passion or admiration or love. And am I wondering who will cherish me when I am old and frightened? On the whole, I am rather relieved that her letter can be taken as a simple negative. No more anxieties and decisions. I shall let the matter drift. As for Gilbert, that waterfly, he is not near my conscience. I rather wonder at Lizzie's touching belief in him. It is true that I could put a most terrible pressure upon both of them, but of course I shall not. No doubt I have done enough damage by simply reminding poor Lizzie of my existence. Do you know what a poltergeist is, Mr. Arkwright? Mr. Arkwright allows a scornful interval to pass while he slowly mops the counter. His silence does not connote hesitation. Yes, sir. The sir is sarcastic, not respectful. Did you ever hear that there was one at Shrough End? No, sir. A what? What did he say? Asks one of the clients. A poltergeist, says Mr. Arkwright. It's a sort of a... He cannot quite say. So I come in. It's a kind of a ghost that breaks things. A ghost? There is a significant silence. You never heard tell that Shrough End was haunted? Any house might be haunted, someone volunteers. Mrs. Chawney haunted it, someone else says. She looked like a... The simile remains elusive. I leave the matter there. My question to Mr. Arkwright was not prompted solely by the fate of my ugly vase. Something rather frightful happened last night. I was wakened at about 5:30, as it turned out, by a most fearful shattering crash down below. It was already daylight, but the hall and stairs are dark, so I lit a candle. I went down, thoroughly frightened, I must confess, and found that the big, oval mirror in the hall had fallen to the ground. The glass was shattered into tiny pieces. What is odd is that both the wire at the back of the mirror and the nail, which remained in the wall, appeared to be intact. I was so appalled and upset I did not stop to investigate properly, and I was afraid that my candle would go out. There was a surprisingly strong draught. I returned promptly to bed. This morning I rather stupidly pulled the nail out of the wall and threw it away without inspecting it properly. Of course the nail must have been gradually bent by the weight of the mirror until the wire slipped over the end. I feel curiously unwilling to reflect about the matter in detail. I'm very sorry about the mirror. The frame is undamaged and it can be re-glazed, but the original glass was mysteriously silvery and beautiful. It took me some time to get to sleep after the crash, and I left my candle burning in the dawn light. When at last I fell asleep, I dreamt that Mrs. Chawney had come out through a door in the alcove to ask me what I was doing in her house. She looked like a... Searching for a place to plant my herb garden, I have found some clumps of excellent young nettles on the other side of the road. I also managed to buy some fresh homemade scones in the village this morning. Some splendid local lady occasionally sells these through the shop. I am told she makes bread too, and I have ordered some. For lunch I ate rashers of cold sugared bacon and poached egg on nettles. Cook the nettles like spinach. I usually make them into a sort of puree with lentils. After that I feasted on the scones with butter and raspberry jam. I drank the local cider and tried to like it. The wine problem is still on the horizon. I have found a few more letters in my dog kennel. They seem to arrive rather irregularly, and I have never yet seen the postman. No word from Lizzie. There is a missive from my cousin James, which I shall record. It is characteristic. My dear Charles, I understand that you have purchased a house by the seaside. Does this mean that you have given up your theatrical activities? If so, it must be a relief no longer to have to do hurried work with a deadline in mind. I trust, in any case, that you are having a well-earned rest in your marine abode, that your things have found satisfactory perches, and that you have a pleasant kitchen wherein to practice your brand of gastronomic mysticism. Have you retained your London flat? I confess I set you down as a dedicated Londoner, so this defection is surprising. I wonder if you have a sea view. The sea is always a refreshment to the spirit. It is good to see the horizon as a clean line. I could do with some ozone myself. The weather in London is intolerably hot, and the temperature seems to increase the traffic noise. Perhaps there is some physical cause for this, connected with sound waves. I expect you are doing a lot of bathing. I always think of you as a fanatical swimming man. Pray let me hear from you in due course, and if you are in town we might have a drink. I hope you are happily settled in and on good terms with your house. I was interested in its curious name. With usual cordial wishes, yours, James. James's letters to me contrived to be slightly patronizing, as if he were an elder brother, not a younger cousin. Indeed, they sometimes achieve that well-meaning, almost parental stiffness which makes one's own doings seem so puerile. At the same time, these letters, of which I regularly receive two or three a year, always seem to me to combine a dull formality with the faintest touch of madness. Perhaps at this point I had better offer some longer and more frank account of my cousin. It is not that James has ever been much of an actor in my life, nor do I anticipate that he will ever now become one. We have steadily seen less of each other over the last 20 years, and lately, although he has been stationed in London, we have scarcely met at all. The reference in his letter to having a drink is, of course, just an empty politesse. I have rarely introduced James to my friends. I always kept him well away from the girls. Nor has he introduced me to his, if he has any. I wonder how he heard about my seaside house. That, too, must be in the newspapers, alas. Is publicity to plague me even here? No, cousin James has never been an important or active figure in the ordinary transactions of my life. His importance lies entirely in my mind. We rarely meet, but when we do, we tread upon a ground which is deep and old. We are both only children, the sons of brothers, close in age. Uncle Abel was slightly younger than my father, who had no other siblings. Though we rarely reminisce, the fact remains that our childhood memories are a common stock which we share with no one else. There are those who, even if valued, remain sinister witnesses from the past. James is, for me, such a witness. It is not even clear whether we like each other. If I were told today that James was dead, my first emotion might be pleasurable. But how much does this prove? Cousinage, dangereux voisinage, had a quite special meaning in our case. I see I have used the past tense, and really when I reflect I see how much all this now belongs to the past. Only the deeper parts of the mind have so little sense of time. As the years have rolled, I have had less and less difficulty in resisting an image of James as a menacing figure. One day a friend, it was Wilfred, meeting him by accident, said, "What a disappointed man your cousin seems to be." A light broke, and I felt better at once. When I was young, I could never decide whether James was real and I was unreal, or vice versa. Somehow it was clear we could not both be real. One of us must inhabit the real world, the other one the world of shadows. James always had a sort of beastly invulnerability. Well, it goes right back to the start. As I have explained, I was early aware, through the sort of psychological osmosis of which children are so capable, that Uncle Abel had made a more advantageous marriage than my father, and that in the mysterious pecking order hierarchy of life, the Abel Arabys ranked above the Adam Arabys. My mother was very conscious of this, and I am certain struggled in the depths of her religious soul not to mind. She had a special way of emphasizing the word heiress when she spoke of Aunt Estelle. My father, I really believe, did not mind at all, except for my sake. I remember his once saying in such an odd, almost humble sort of voice, "I'm so sorry you can't have a pony, like James." I loved my father so intensely at that moment, and was at the same time conscious, I was 10, 12, that I could not express my love, and that perhaps he did not know of it, how much it was. Did he ever know? As far as the material things of life were concerned, the families certainly had different fates. James was the proud possessor of the above-mentioned pony, indeed of a series of such animals, and generally lived in what I thought of as a pony-owning style. And how I suffered from those bloody ponies. When I visited Ramsden's, James sometimes offered me a ride, and Uncle Abel, also a horseman, wanted to take me out on a leading rein. Although passionately anxious to ride, I always, out of pride and with a feigned indifference, refused, and to this day I have never sat on a horse. A perhaps more important, though not more burning, occasion of envy was continental travel. The Abel Arabys went abroad almost every school holiday. They drove all over Europe. We, of course, had no car. They went to America to stay with Aunt Estelle's folks, about whom I was careful to know as little as possible. I did not leave England until I went to Paris with Clement after the war. It was not only their ponies and their wide-ranging motor cars that I envied here, it was their enterprise. Uncle Abel was an arranger, an adventurer, an inventor, even a hedonist. My dear good father was none of these things. My uncle and aunt never invited me to join them on those wonderful journeys. It only much later occurred to me, and the idea entered my mind like a dart. I dare say it is still sticking in there somewhere, that they did not ask me because James vetoed it. As I said, the situation worried my father, I think, only on my behalf. It worried me on my behalf, too, but also, and quite separately, on his. I resented, for him, his deprived status. I felt, for him, the chagrin which his generous and sweet nature did not feel for himself. And in doing this I was aware, even as a child, that I thereby showed myself to be his moral inferior. Although I had such a happy home and such loving parents, I could not help bitterly coveting things which at the same time, as I looked at my father, I despised. I could not help regarding Uncle Abel and Aunt Estelle as glamorous, almost godlike beings, in comparison with whom my own parents seemed insignificant and dull. I could not help seeing them, in that comparison, as failures. While at the same time I also knew that my father was a virtuous and unworldly man, whereas Uncle Abel, who was so stylish, was an ordinary, average, completely selfish person. I do not, of course, imply that my uncle was a cad or a bounder. He certainly was not. He loved his beautiful wife, and as far as I know was faithful to her. He was, as far as I know, an affectionate and responsible father. I'm sure he was honest and conscientious in his work and in his finances. In fact, a model citizen. But he was an ordinary, self-centred go-getter, an ordinary sensualist, whereas my father, although perhaps nobody ever knew this except my mother and me, was something quite else, something special. None of this stopped me from rather worshipping Uncle Abel and dancing around him like a pleased dog. At least I did so when I was a young child. Later, because of James, I was slightly more dignified and aloof. Was my father sometimes hurt because I found Uncle Abel so picturesque? Perhaps. This thought saddens me now as I write, with a special, piercing sadness. He did not care about the worldly goods, but, though he never showed it, he might have felt sorry, again for my sake, that he was so much less of a figure. My mother may have intuited some such regret in him, or perhaps to her he expressed it, and this may have contributed to the irritability which she could not always suppress when the Abel Arabys were mentioned, or especially when they had lately been with us on a visit. They did not, in fact, visit us very often, since my mother felt that we could not entertain them in sufficient style, and would embarrass them when they did come with aggressive apologies concerning our humbler way of life. We, I should add, lived upon a housing estate where loneliness was combined with lack of privacy. My visits to stone-built, tree-surrounded Ramsdens were usually made alone, because of my mother's horror of being under her brother-in-law's roof, and my father's horror of being under any roof except his own. I must now, in mentioning my mother, speak of Aunt Estelle. She was, as I have said, an American, though where exactly she hailed from I do not remember to have discovered. America was a big, vague concept to me then. Nor do I know where or how my uncle met her. She certainly represented to me some general idea of America, freedom, gaiety, noise. Where Aunt Estelle was, there was laughter, jazz music, and, how shocking, alcohol. This, again, might give the wrong impression. I am speaking of a child's dream. Aunt Estelle was no drinker, and her wildness was the merest good spirits, health, youth, beauty, money. She had the instinctive generosity of the thoroughly lucky person. She was, in a vague way, demonstratively affectionate to me when I was a child. My undemonstrative mother watched these perhaps meaningless effusions coldly, but they moved me. Aunt Estelle had a pretty little singing voice and used to chant the songs of the First War and the latest romantic song hits, Roses of Picardy, Tiptoe Through the Tulips, Oh So Blue, Me and Jane in a Plane, and other classics of that sort. I remember once when she came one night at Ramsden's to settle me down, her singing a song to the effect that there ain't no sense sitting on the fence all by yourself in the moonlight. I found this very droll. I made the mistake of trying to amuse my parents by repeating it. It ain't no fun sitting neath the trees, giving yourself a hug and giving yourself a squeeze. It is probably in some way because of Aunt Estelle that the human voice singing has always upset me, with a deep and almost frightening emotion. There is something strange and awful about the distorted open mouths of singers, especially women, the wet, white teeth, the moist, red interior. Altogether, my aunt was for me a symbolic figure, a modern figure, even a futuristic figure, a sort of prophetic lure into my own future. She lived in a land which I was determined to find and to conquer for myself, and in a way I did. But by the time I was king there, she was already dead, and it seems strange to think that we never really knew each other, never really talked to each other at all. How easily, later on, we could have bridged the years, and how much we would have enjoyed each other's company. I mentioned her occasionally to Clement, who said she was the only one of my relations she would have liked to meet. My parents, of course, never met Clement, since it would have made them very unhappy to know that I was living openly with a woman twice my age. But I could have introduced her to my aunt. When Aunt Estelle was killed in a motor accident when I was 16, I was less upset than I expected. I had other troubles by then, but it is sad to think that although she was so kind to me in her absent-minded way, she probably never thought of me except as James's awkward, boorish, undistinguished little cousin. She was a marvel to me, a portent. Sorting out oddments at Shraff End 2 days ago, I came across a photograph of her. I could not find one of my mother. My mother did not exactly dislike Aunt Estelle, nor violently disapprove of her, though she shuddered at the noise and the drink, and she was not exactly envious because she did not want the worldly things that pleased Aunt Estelle. She was just thoroughly depressed by her existence and cast into the gloom and irritation which I mentioned earlier by her visits. It may be that my uncle and aunt thought that my upbringing was too strict. Outsiders who see rules and not the love that runs through them are often too ready to label other people as prisoners. It is conceivable that clever Uncle Abel and liberated Aunt Estelle actually pitied my father and myself, and blamed my mother for what they regarded as a repressive regime. If my mother suspected the existence of such judgments, she must have felt pain and resentment, and this resentment may even have had the effect of making her still stricter with us. It is also possible that, divining my childish fantasies concerning that America which Aunt Estelle represented to me, she felt jealous. Much later, I wondered if she imagined that my father was attracted by his vivacious sister-in-law. In fact, I'm sure that he had no deep feelings of any sort about Aunt Estelle, except again in relation to me, and that my mother must have known this. How egoistic I sound as I describe myself as the centre of my parents' world. But I was the centre of their world. In the end, I ceased looking forward to Aunt Estelle's visits, although they always excited me when they happened, because they made my mother so depressed and cross. Our house was always somehow spoilt by these visits and took a little time to recover. As the able Araby Rolls-Royce was finally waved away down the street, my mother would fall silent, answer in monosyllables, while my father and I tiptoed about, avoiding each other's eyes. I was happy at school, but there were no close friendships. No dramas there, no dearly beloved schoolmasters, though some influential ones, such as Mr. McDowell. My aunt and uncle loomed as large, significant, romantic figures, focuses of obscure emotion, in a childhood which was, in a way, curiously empty. Yet also they were remote, a little hazy, a little cloudy, partly, of course, because they were only marginally interested in me. I never felt that they really saw me, or even looked at me much. With Cousin James it was far otherwise. Silently, James and I, from earliest moments, were acutely, suspiciously, constantly aware of each other. We watched each other, and by a mute instinct kept this close mutual attention largely secret from our parents. I cannot say that we feared each other. The fear was all mine, and was a fear not exactly of James, but of something that James stood for. This something was, I suppose, my prophetic, veiled conception of my own life as a failure, as a total disaster. But we lived, in relation to each other, in a cloud of discomfort and anxiety. All this, of course, in silence. We never spoke of this strange tension between us. Perhaps we would not have been able to find words for it, and I doubt if our parents had any idea of it. Even my father, who knew that I envied James, had no conception of this. As I have indicated, part of my unease about my cousin consisted in a fear that he would succeed in life and I would fail. That, on top of the ponies, would have been too much. It is scarcely possible to say how far my will to power was inspired by a deep, original intent to outshine James and to impress him. I do not think that James felt any special desire to impress me. Or perhaps he knew that he did not have to try. He had all the advantages. He received, and this is where I really began to grind my teeth, a better education than I did. I went to the local grammar school, a dull, decent school now defunct. James went to Winchester. Perhaps this was a mixed blessing. In a way, he never recovered. But they say they rarely do. I got myself a reasonably sound education, and especially I got Shakespeare. But James, it seemed to me then, was learning everything. He knew Latin and Greek and several modern languages. I had only a little French and less Latin. He knew about painting and regularly visited art galleries in Europe and America. He chatted familiarly of foreign places. He was good at mathematics. He won prizes for history. He wrote poetry, which was published in the school magazine. He shone. And although he was not at all boastful, I increasingly felt myself, and was made to feel, a provincial barbarian when I was with James. I felt a gap between us widen, and that gap, as I more intelligently surveyed it, began to fill me with despair. Clearly my cousin was destined for success, and I for failure. I wonder how much my father understood of all this. Rereading these paragraphs, I feel again that I am giving the wrong impression. What a difficult form autobiography is proving to be. the chagrin, the ferocious ambition which James, I'm sure quite unconsciously, prompted in me was something which came about gradually and raged intermittently. When we were younger, and even when we were older, James and I played together as ordinary boys play. I had few friends, partly because my mother did not want to invite other children to the house. I did not mind. I did not like other children very much, and if James had friends, he kept them away from me. So we played alone with each other, watching each other, but not always as crammed with consciousness as the above description might seem to imply. Even in ordinary play, however, some effortless superiority of James's would tend to emerge. He knew far more than I did about birds and flowers, and was very good at climbing trees. As a small child, I remember his most seriously attempting to learn to fly. He could find his way across country like a fox. He had a sort of uncanny instinct about things and places. When the ball got lost, it was always James who found it, and he once instantly recovered an old toy aeroplane of mine simply on the basis of my having told him I had lost it. When I was causing misery to my parents by learning the histrionic arts in London, James was being a golden boy at Oxford, where he studied history. At this time I lost touch with him. I did not crave further news of his triumphs, and quite positively did not want to know what Cousin James was up to. Whatever it was, he never finished it, because the war arrived. He joined something called the Rifle Corps, later called the Green Jackets, and thus began, though I think he did not realize it at the time, a lifetime as a soldier. Indeed, it is now hard for me to think of James at all except as a soldier. He had quite an interesting war, while I was going round in buses playing Shakespeare to coal miners. After a while I heard he was in India, at Dehradun. I had my own problems, notably first love and its after-effects, then the opening skirmishes in my long war with Clement. I heard the outlines of James's adventures later. He climbed various mountains. He became interested in Tibet, learnt Tibetan, and was constantly disappearing over the border on his pony. All that early training must have come in useful. Then he was sent on some embassy or embassies to some nearby Tibetan ruler about something to do with German prisoners of war. He had a picturesque time, but I think he never saw any real action. I was always afraid of hearing he had won the VC. Of course, I have never doubted that he is, in a sense in which I am not, a brave man. My parents were very surprised when it turned out after the war that James had decided to become a professional soldier. They said that Uncle Abel was disappointed by the decision. Uncle Abel saw James as Prime Minister. Aunt Estelle was dead by then. I felt obscurely cheered because I intuited that James had taken a wrong turning. I was by then just beginning to do well in the theatre. My will to power was bringing in results, and Clement was in my life like a sort of travelling carnival. So Cousin James was to be a soldier. Uncle Abel said that it was only temporary, and he was doing it so as to have more time to write poetry. My mother said that Uncle Abel was whistling in the dark. It did not seem to occur to any of us then that the army, too, is, and traditionally, a road to power and glory. I saw little of James after the war, in that rather moving time of the reunion of survivors, but then he vanished again. He was always vanishing. He came back from India and was posted to Germany. Then he was in England again at the Staff College, then back to India. Someone told me later that he was sent on a secret mission into Tibet to investigate Soviet activity there. Of course, James never told me anything about his work. I knew minimally of his travels because, with increasing regularity, he sent me picture postcards at Christmas and on my birthday. I paid him no such attentions, but if he wrote me a letter, I always sent a brief reply. His letters were usually dull, always uninformative. Then he turned up in London just after the Chinese invasion of Tibet. I never saw him, before or since, display so much emotion. This was clearly for him a personal tragedy. He exclaimed bitterly about the stupidity of those who had failed to see that China, not Russia, was the real menace. But what grieved him was not this ignoring of, perhaps his own, good advice, so much as the destruction of something he loved. This emotion was soon muted, and he never spoke of the matter to me again. The next postcard I received was from Singapore, and the next letter, also from Singapore, was a condolence on my father's death. I wonder how he knew. After that I lost sight of James, because for a time I lost sight of everything. The lights went out in my life. I mourned long and miserably for my father. The loss of that dear good man touches me deeply still. And, as if in sympathy, everything else was wrong. I had left Clement and was wretchedly involved with some other ladies, and my professional career had crashed into what appeared to be irrevocable ruin. My mother's death not long after seemed less an individual event than a sort of doomed extension of the loss of my father. A little later, Uncle Abel died. I had long ago stopped caring about him, or even thinking about him. I recall that I intended to write to James, but I never wrote. I recall, too, that I wondered only then how James had felt when his marvellous mother died when he was a boy. I was deep in my own early sorrows at that time, and was not greatly affected by Aunt Estelle's fate. I somehow never reflected what it might have done to James. I mentioned just now, and should have named him, his name is Toby Ellesmere, a man who told me about James's secret missions in Tibet. This man, not remarkable in any other way, sometimes brought me news of my cousin. They had been together at school and also in the Green Jackets. Ellesmere became a stockholder, then a publisher, and also dabbled in theatre matters as an investor, and in this context I came across him. Sometime just after my bad patch, we met at a first-night party, and Ellesmere said, "I suppose you know your cousin has become a Buddhist." I was fascinated and amazed by this news. I had never connected James with religion. We had both of us acquired that vague English Christianity which disappears in adolescence. My mother, I should say here, did not force her particular evangelical beliefs upon my father and me. Perhaps she realized that it would not do. However, she took it for granted that we were Christians. We attended an Anglican church. Naturally, James and I did not discuss religion. If I had considered the matter when we were young, I think I would have said that the basic spiritual principle of James's life was an avoidance of vulgarity. Religion as good form? One could do worse. I would never have imagined him as an enthusiast in pursuit of the exotic mysteries of the East. How extremely odd. My surprise soon wore off. What did it mean after all? Obviously, James could not believe in the transmigration of souls. When I met my cousin again, it was somehow another era in our lives. My father's death, my period of professional despair, my misadventures in Hollywood, these things were now behind me. I had made peace with Clement. We were in Japan together. I was, by now, a very successful man. In Aunt Estelle's country, a king indeed. I said to James, "Sir, you're a Buddhist, I hear." He smiled and said, "Oh, yes," in a tone which could mean either yes or what nonsense. I dropped the subject. Later on, he came to live more permanently in London and to work in the Ministry of Defence, as he still does. His flat in Pimlico is full of Buddhas, but then it is full of all sorts of Eastern trash, some of it, I dare say, Hindu. James is now a general, of course, I forget what kind. I suppose he, too, has been, in a way, a successful man. My own feeling that I have won the game comes partly from a sense that he has been disappointed by life, whereas I have not. "A man would drown there in a second. 3 seconds. A second. 3 seconds." Example of Black Lion conversation and level of debate. The clientele seem to resent the fact that I go swimming in a sea whose killer propensities they're so proud of. Conversations of this sort arise as soon as I appear, not, of course, addressed to me. I join in. "I'm a strong swimmer. It's them that drowns. You swim bare," someone adds. "Bare? You swim bare? Oh, you mean naked." So I am watched. They look at me with dull, silent hostility. "Seen any seals?" Mr. Arkwright asks brightly. "No, not yet." I was sorry to observe, visiting the tower steps this morning, that my curtain, rope, had also somehow come undone and vanished. I swam, nevertheless. I think that my muscles are stronger and I'm becoming more skilful at climbing out. I always manage to scrape or cut myself, however. The yellow rocks, which look so smooth from a distance, have a rough, scratchy surface, as if they were closely covered over with millions of tiny, sharp, broken-off limpet shells. Yesterday I dived from Shrough End Cliff at high tide and managed to get out all right, though a little anxiety has spoilt the swim. I'm certainly not going to lose face at the Black Lion by going along to the ladies' bathing place. Today there is a pleasant, very light haze over the whole sky, and the sea has a misleadingly docile, silvered look, as if the substantial wavelets were determined to